Committee, the order which we will go this afternoon is we'll do our work sessions first on 2166, and then on 2043. And then we will begin a hearing, and hearing only, on House Bill 2747. The major portion that we're going to hear is the proposed business activity education tax. So if you're here for the SUV portion, please feel free to wave your hand and let me know. But the intended purpose of the testimony is really for House Bill 2747, and we will return to the other portion of the bill at some point. Open work session on House Bill 2166. Elizabeth.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 2166, we heard it a month ago, and basically we have now the dash B5s. And what this does is, from conversations after our last hearing, this basically tries to reduces the total certified cost amount allowed for the farm worker housing credit, and it reduces it enough so it makes it revenue neutral between the 2003-05 biennium and the 2005-07 biennium. So basically it's reducing that overall cap to $7.25 million each year. It's currently at $7.5 million, and that begins, though, tax year 2003, where the rest of the provisions in the bill that have a revenue impact in the sense of allowing the housing credit to be sold, 100% of it to be sold, begins January 1st, 2005. So what we see then on the revenue impact statement is, in 2003-05 biennium, you have a positive $250,000. And then in the 2005-07 biennium, you then have that reduction of $206,525. So overall, there's a small positive general fund gain of $43,475 between those two bienniums. But basically, that was the compromise to come up with a zero revenue impact between the 2003-05 biennium and 2005-07 biennium.
Thank you. And Lynn, I believe you worked with Senator Farioli on this amendment.
Yes, Senator Deckard, I did. And we're very happy with them. Basically, what this does is it reduces our cap. Pardon me?
For the record.
For the record, my name is Lynn Parton from Housing and Community Services Department. And I, among other things, run the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit Program that we're discussing here. And I have also been in touch with a number of the other people who were involved in the legislatively established Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force and other folks who have been involved very much with the farm worker housing issue. And everybody is on board with this. We are very happy with this compromise. It's $250,000 less per year in cap, but it's in essence going to trade us off $1.2 million in actual tax credits that are not fictional. They'll be real now, because almost $6 million of the $7.5 million go to nonprofits who have to transfer them to somebody to get equity into the project. And so $6 million times 20% of that being currently not able to be taken looks like a really good trade-off for us. So we're very pleased with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Farioli, do you wish to? I know you helped prepare these amendments.
Just to nod wisely, Mr. Chairman.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
I could nod.
Any questions for Ms. Parton?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Don't thank us yet. We haven't done. We're in work session. If the committee wishes to move the B5 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Move B5 amendments.
Senator Ringo has moved the dash B5 amendments to House Bill 2166. Any discussion? Tara, please call the roll.
Vice President?
Aye.
Lennon?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
Carr?
Aye.
Farioli?
Aye.
Becker?
Is an aye. Carries.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
Move the bill as amended to do best recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, point of procedural order.
Yes, please.
On 2747, is that what we're doing? Oh, I beg your pardon.
2166.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question's answered.
We have not moved 2747. Thank you. With Senator Schrader's amendment to the floor. Senator Clark.
Are we intending to move bills then?
I think we are.
I made that motion.
Motion's been moved. Further discussion? Chair, please.
Senator Scarton?
Aye.
Cannon?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Crayoli?
Aye.
Deckard?
Is an aye. Motion carries. Do you want to carry?
I'd be happy to carry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli will carry the bill. Now you can thank us, Lynn. Open a work session on House Bill 2043. Elizabeth.
Chairman Deckard, what this bill was, again, we've heard this one other time, it allows a corporate excise tax credit for corporations that provide motor vehicle insurance based on the number of miles traveled or time-based rating insurance plans. Basically specifying that an eligible corporation must provide this motor vehicle insurance policies that are at least 70% based on the mileage-based or time-based rating plans. It limits the corporate tax credit to $100 per vehicle, $300 per policy, and the credit can be only claimed once per policy. And it restricts the excise tax credit total to $1 million of actual tax credit claims. And it's beginning January 1st, 2005, and it ends on January 1st, 2010. So the revenue impact will be felt in the 2005-07 biennium and the 07-09 biennium for a total of $1 million between the two bienniums.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
There are no amendments to this bill, correct?
No amendments.
Not that I'm aware of.
Move House Bill 2043, A, engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2043, engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be voting no on this. At the same time, we're trying to raise revenue. Here comes another measure. We just gave away $7 million, and now here's another $1 million on top of it. $1 million here, $1 million there. Pretty soon you're talking real money. And I still have yet to see a school finance plan that funds our schools. And so for that reason, I'm going to be voting no.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli.
I have a ream of information on pay-as-you-drive, mostly from areas that have access to public transit, mass transit, and alternatives. And the issue for me is that most of rural Oregon has no such alternatives. I realize this is a permissive opportunity, that is, it permits this offering, but nobody has yet been able to answer for me if individuals will be able to opt into a program like this and affect a cost savings, where those costs will be shifted to. And before I vote on this bill, I'd like to hear somebody explain if there are savings to be had, all things being equal, where those costs to be shifted to. And I've sought an answer to that question. Nobody's answered it. So if that would be possible for some of the proponents to tell me if there are savings to be had, and the rates will go down for some motorists, how will those losses and those savings be made up, and to whom will those costs be shifted?
Mm-hmm.
If I could
would
ask
you
the
like
proponents
is that
a question.
Mr. Blevins, do you want
to? For the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council, Chair Deckard, Senator Farioli. The understanding and the premise that we're moving on with this idea is that for every 10% reduction you see on average in the mileage that somebody drives, you can see a corresponding reduction of anywhere from 14 to 18% in their accident rate. And this is based on a number of different studies that have been done nationally and internationally. So the presumption is that if you do this type of an insurance policy, that the corresponding savings that you'd see would come from that decrease in outlays for accidents that you'd see for the companies.
I guess my question, Mr. Blevins, is that if I live in Long Creek, Oregon, how would I cut my mileage if my kids' dentist appointments are in John Day and my travel to school and recreational activities and county fair, rodeo, FFA programs and projects? How do I cut my mileage if I live in that community?
Well, again, Senator Perioli, the goal here is this is not necessarily going to be a program that's going to benefit everybody equally across the state. There are some people who are going to be able to take more advantage of it than others. This wouldn't penalize you because presumably you wouldn't sign up for it because you wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. But this would be more targeted at, say, a neighbor of yours who was elderly, who didn't have to take as many trips as you did and had maybe half the mileage that you drove, who would be able to presumably save some money there. So it's targeted more at those type of folks who do have that opportunity because they're needs to travel aren't necessarily as much as yours.
Okay. Mr. Blevins, I think that's an excellent answer. To whom will those savings, those savings represent a cost or a loss for the company. To whom will those costs be shifted?
Again, the presumption is within a overall insurance pool. If you see a decrease in overall trips that you're taking, overall mileage, that because your outlays are less for accidents, that's where you're making the savings.
And, Mr. President, if there's a, say, if this program is wildly successful and there's a 30% reduction in costs, are we expecting the companies to take 30% less in earnings?
Again, we make no presumption about what kind of savings you're going to see on the consumer, and that's, again, up to the companies to figure out what actuarially works for them so that they continue to make a profit and while still providing the services. But when Progressive Insurance did a pilot of this program down in Texas, people on average saved 25%.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you've got here is a piston model. If you push it, if you push the cost down for a group of folks that can take advantage of this bill, you push the costs up for other people. I think that's there's a coefficient there. And I think the folks that have no access to mass transit are making trips that that other folks might consider optional but are not really considered optional in rural areas. Then those folks simply do not have access to any savings in this kind of a program. And my fear is that with the best of intentions, and I certainly accord the best of intentions to the proponents of this bill, what will be created as an unintentional consequence is cost shifting to rural areas. So I'll be a no on this bill, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman. You just got a promotion.
And now,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Ringo.
Well, just a comment. I think that people that live in urban areas have their insurance rated against others who live in urban areas because they face different risks. That's why people who live in Portland pay higher insurance than people who live in Long Creek or John Day, just because there's a lot more risks to driving in Portland. And so it's not a matter of comparing the insurance premiums of somebody in Portland to somebody who lives in Long Creek. And I think rural folks will be rated against other rural folks and urban folks against other urban folks. And so I don't think this is something that will make it more expensive for rural drivers. It's not the intent, and I don't think that would happen in actual practice. And so I would encourage its passage. I think it makes sense for a lot of reasons that we discussed in our earlier hearings.
Where is Long Creek?
Outside of John Day.
Senator Corcoran. Mr. Chair, I agreed to give this vote a courtesy vote to get to the floor for a vote, but I actually disagree with my good colleague's analysis. The fact of the matter is, even if it doesn't put rural and urban folks competing against each other in a rural setting, there's really not much choice in terms of having to drive high miles, given some of the examples that Senator Farioli gave. And if there's a retired rural couple out there that doesn't have to travel a lot and can cut down their travel, they would be the beneficiary of this, but I don't think this bill treats rural folks equally, and I'll be opposing it on the floor, but I agree to let it go up for a vote.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Hobson, would you want to get in on this one?
No, thank you, sir.
Tara, please call the roll.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Cannon?
No.
Ringo?
Aye.
Sarah?
Aye.
Ariel?
No.
Eckert?
It's an aye. Motion carries. Cineringo. We'll carry the bill. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2747. Again, this is a hearing on the business education proposal and not on the SUV portion of the bill, and it'll only be a public hearing and no work session this afternoon. Senator Schrader, you want to come up and we'll let McCall introduce the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there's a couple of things packets there relating to the analysis of this. It's the 2747, the B8 amendment, and this has a revenue plan embedded in it that introduces a business activity tax on 1/1/2005 at 2.75%. There are several features to it. There is a filing threshold of $100,000 in gross receipts. There's a $25,000 zero bracket amount, meaning the first $25,000 of business activity is not taxed, and it exempts agriculture. It also has a schedule for lower personal income tax rates of 4, 6, and 8%, and it phases out the corporate income tax in two steps, beginning in 2005, and then in 2006 there's a zero corporate income tax rate. And it also reduces capital gains taxes to 4%, and it expands the earned income credit from 5% of the federal to 100% of the federal and maintains it as a non-refundable credit. You can see on the first page there of the packet titled Tax Reform Package, there are revenue estimates from that. And because it starts in 1105, we're estimating that we'll get a little less than half a year of business activity tax collections, and that's about $762 million. We're estimating a $310 million reduction in income taxes and a $72 million reduction in corporate income taxes for a net increase of $381 million for the 2003-2005 period. 2005-2007, the business activity tax grows to about $3.5 billion. And the personal income tax reduction to about $1.6 billion, and then there's an elimination of the corporate income tax for a net gain of a little over $1.4 billion. We have done a number of different estimates with different rates, and I'm sure Senator Schrader will address some of those. The rest of the material in your packet, there's a description of the tax base itself. And you can see that the tax base sums up what economists call the factors of production, returns to labor and returns to capital plus rent. It subtracts out capital expenditures. And you can see it takes away $25,000 as a zero bracket amount and applies a tax rate of 2.75% to that base. We do have some information on returns that we have not been able to update at this point, but this gives you a sense of the distribution of the business activity tax for all business type filers, including subchapter S corporations, that there's a fairly significant number of taxpayers that would not file under this because they have less than $100,000 in gross receipts. The next page lays out the VAT base for corporate is the only area where we really have the detail on industry, but it lays out the industry on taxpayers. You can see the ag, forestry, and fisheries is about 1.2%. We estimate for the overall base it's about 1.5%. And, of course, remember that that's exempt under the bill. The next set of analysis is on the OTIM results, and I don't know if you want to have Senator Schrader go through the plan, and then we could come back and talk about those results.
Yeah. Senator Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. Appreciate the opportunity and the kindness of the chair in letting this amendment be heard. Hopefully it's the beginning of a discussion that will actually lead us to a thoughtful way to do things here in the state of Oregon. And I appreciate Senator Ringo's kindness in letting us have the discussion on a bill that he has a great deal of interest in. That's a very good bill, so I appreciate that very much. I'd like to make some general comments, if I may, Mr. Chair, and then focus down on why I think this is a pretty good idea. I guess I'm here to ask you and us as legislators to do the visionary leadership thing and quite frankly, step up to the plate and show people in this state that we really care about how we do things and how our system of government works. This is indeed the greatest economic crisis in Oregon history, at least since the Great Depression some 70 years ago. I hope to be able to convince you, either today or in the course of the next few weeks that we're here, three things. One, we need tax reform. We need it right now. And that slashing income tax and instituting this dedicated business education tax is probably the best way to go about it. To me, this is a fairly simple decision. Which one of us would not want to vote for a bill that gave 70% of Oregonians a big cut in their income taxes and at the same time dedicated funding to K-12? I mean, that seems like a no-brainer to me. I would assume that would be an obvious yes vote. So maybe all this is talk is rhetorical, but I'll go through it anyway. There are some cold hard facts I think we need to be aware of that I think have contributed, unfortunately, to our plight in Oregon right now. With New York, we have the highest personal income tax rates in the nation. We have the second highest capital gains tax. We're in the top half of the nation in corporate income tax. Is it any wonder why big businesses don't want to come to Oregon? And is it any wonder that on April 15th, people feel like they're getting taxed out of their homes with income tax rates like they are? And our dependence on income tax is killing us here at the state level. We are all too aware of that, and hopefully some of the people outside the building are becoming aware of that, too. We've been the worst-hit state in the nation with our dependence on income tax. Our revenues are down, you know, some 20-25%. Most states, it's a 5 or 6% drop that they've enjoyed because of a more stable system. That's because we have only one, basically one source of discretionary funds for our general fund, and that's income tax with a little bit of lottery on the side. Income tax is, you know, in the 90% range of our discretionary income. I believe you have some graphs in your packets that show how Oregon has fared with the decline in revenues compared to the nation as a whole, and then again compared to our colleague to the north, our state to just to the north of us, which has a stable consumption tax. People in Oregon begin paying income tax at the $13,000 level. They hit the highest bracket by, you know, a couple anyway, by about $26,000, and that's ridiculous, folks. That's a bad comment about the regressivity of our system here. I think for business, the saying goes that Oregon's a great place to start a business, but a poor one to be successful in, given our high income taxes. You're penalized, basically, for being successful. It's no wonder, I think, that businessmen and businesswomen migrate to Washington as their company matures, where the tax system is more executive-friendly. I think a key point to be made here is that our great state basically right now is being divided into two. It was alluded to in the previous hearing on the previous bill. We've got urban Oregon and we've got rural Oregon, and that divide is getting greater. Urban Oregon can afford to pay higher taxes. Rural Oregon, where the heady economic times of the 90s passed us by, just can't. Urban Oregon will probably likely weather the storm. They're voting to impose higher income tax surcharges right now, but frankly because they have the business tax base to do that. The individual is not going to be on the hook necessarily. Rural Oregon cares, I think, as much about schools, seniors, and community safety as urban Oregon, but they just flat don't have the business tax base to pay higher taxes. I believe we're in grave danger of permanently creating longstanding structural and economic differences that will really destroy our state. Oh, Kurt, geez, it's fascinating, but, you know, people aren't ready for taxes in any way, shape, or form. I know it's almost revenue neutral in 0305, but, you know, gosh, we're in the middle of a recession. Isn't this going to hurt the economy? Let's wait a few years. Frankly, we don't trust you legislative people. And that's all the arguments you hear. I think that's just fascinating. Let's just abrogate our responsibility as elected representatives of the people. Let's just not do anything. Let's let some less informed individual at a kitchen table somewhere in Oregon write up a half-baked initiative, back of a napkin. Oh, let's see, we did that. Measure 5. Measure 5, we spent two sessions. Revenue committees, when I came to this building, we spent two sessions trying to fix that bill. You know, I would say also on the positive side of Measure 5, I mean, why did that happen? That happened because we refused to listen to the people. In that case, they wanted to reduce our property tax burden. And again, the legislature didn't do anything, and then we had it done to us. And I think in the end the people had it done to them because of the style of that initiative. We need to step up to the plate. I think if we're waiting for Oregonians to rise up in righteous indignation, I think we can guess again. Folks, it's not going to happen. People are beaten down right now. After 2 years and six special sessions, people are hunkering down. It's all about them. They're just trying to survive. Quite frankly, what have we done to earn their trust and respect? I think it's time for us to show them we're willing to help, we're willing to lead. Oh, just wait, Kurt. We need to educate them. You know, people don't realize there's a problem. I wonder how much more education they really need. We've got the highest unemployment in the nation. We're the hungriest state in the nation. We have the shortest school year in the nation. Our schools, had to close early this year. We are pushing people out of nursing homes. You know, we're taking people's life-saving medication away. We're closing juvenile corrections facilities and turning rapists and sex offenders back into the community. I don't know how much more education the state of Oregon can stand at this point in time. I think it's time for us to snap out of it, wake up a little bit. I think the public is ready for the tax reform debate. And if you wait at this point, let's talk very practical. Say we decide to wait. Yeah, sure, we'll just wait a year or two and, you know, out of the desert the Fremen come and tell us what to do. That's fine. But by the time they get around to that, it takes another 12 or 18 months to put this thing into effect. It's 4 years down the line. Heck, it's 07, 09. Economy hopefully will have turned around by itself on then and people, oh, geez, we really don't need to do this. You know, we'll just limp along like we always do. And then we'll revisit the same problem here another 15, 20 years. So I think the state we know and we love will be gone, frankly, at that point in time. So, okay, cut to the chase, Kurt. We need to act right now. Drastically reduce our dependence on income taxes, fund essential services like a full school year, opportunities for Oregonians to go from welfare to work, provide basic housing and medication for the greatest generation as they enter their later years. We need to diversify our tax base, like any well-run business diversifies its revenues. And we need to encourage economic development right now. We can't wait for our state economic development department. I personally believe our own existing private enterprise system will be the engine of economic growth in this state, not the state itself. And we need to dedicate a funding source for K-12 so it can perform well into the 21st century, not drain away the precious dollars. It's 44% of our budget, as you know right now, from essential human service and public safety programs. So the solution, we need the Business Education Income Tax Reduction Act that you now have before you. We need to cut income taxes and institute a stable consumption tax dedicated to schools. That's what this session really is all about. This proposal, as I said, gives 70% of all Oregonians a dramatic income tax break and provides dedicated funding stream for these schools. It assures us that all Oregonians will be paying their fair share and supporting essential services. No longer will 65% of Oregon's corporations pay only $10 in taxes while citizens shoulder the weight of public services. No longer will the poorest of the poor be forced into high tax brackets as they work their way out of poverty. Earned income tax credits are raised to a level to be meaningful and reduce the regressivity of our current tax structure. At the same time, quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, businesses will be able to have some of their most fervent prayers answered with regard to high income tax. Corporate tax is eliminated. Capital gains are cut in half. We rocket from the top half of the nation in corporate tax burden to the lowest, from second in capital gains to about 32nd. And corporate executives get an incentive to stay in Oregon as the top personal rate is also cut. Immediate economic development is promoted in this bill by taking away the disincentive to make a profit. This is exactly the right time to make a change in the business tax structure. We're in all likelihood, hopefully, at the bottom of this recessionary cycle. Business has had the advantage of not paying taxes with our current tax structure as this economy has worsened. That same structure will now work against them as the economy recovers. This is the time to go to a consumption tax that does not really tax profits. Oregon will not only be in a good state to start a business, but also be a good state to be successful in business. The tax calculations you see before you allows Oregon businesses to expense off 100% of their capital investments in this existing tax year. That's a huge boon to this economy right here, right now. Unlike a sales tax, this consumption tax is 100% deductible. Oregonians' money stays in Oregon. The bill anticipates that this consumption tax is indeed passed on to consumers. That's what a consumption tax does. In fact, a section of the bill you'll see encourages business to note on the invoice that a portion of the purchase price of any product or service you buy is Oregon's business education tax. I personally think that instead of being vilified and judged by Enron accounting standards, business will benefit by making Oregonians aware that they have stepped up to the plate in fronting the cost of dedicated school funding. This is a priority that's eluded Oregon for the last 50 years. Since all Oregon business pays the same rate, I don't believe there's any competitive disadvantage. Indeed, 45 other states have a sales tax or this business activities tax type of proposal, so there's really no national disadvantage. And given our low overall tax burden in Oregon, 46th in the nation, and our movement to single sales tax factors, I think there's very little international disadvantage. I believe it's time for businesses like mine to step up, lead the way out of this dark spirit that seems to be permeating Oregon right now. No business will come to Oregon, an Oregon that's laughingstock of the nation, featured in Doonesbury, one that's perceived to have a second-rate education system, one that's unsafe to live in and actually puts our senior citizens out on the street. No business will come to Oregon that has the highest income taxes in the nation to a state where profit-making is a sin. Frankly, it's time to change all that, ladies and gentlemen. It's long overdue for Oregon to change to a state that values economic development, job creation, and essential services. I think it's time for business and this legislature to step up and chart a progressive future for our great state. And I'm open to particular questions, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Kurt, first of all, I really want to congratulate you for the work you put into this, and I think you're getting people off the dime, which is really important. I don't know. You know, I keep asking what we'll get for tax reform in this session, and I'm telling them that, in essence, whatever we do in terms of raising additional revenue to meet our services is going to constitute tax reform to some degree, but not the kind of tax reform you contemplate. But the one area I have a problem with is the correlation between the Bush tax plan, Bush tax breaks for the wealthy, and your proposal on personal income tax. The difficulty I have is that I got some information from the Citizens for Tax Justice, and the difficulty I have is that Oregon ranks somewhere in the middle in terms of the impact of the Bush tax plan. But what happens in Oregon is the lowest 60% get an average of $368 tax reduction over the next 4 years. The wealthiest, they have a figure here for the wealthiest 1%, but I think that's unfair. But just taking the wealthiest quintile, their ranges in four-year average tax cuts and this quintile starts at $91,000. They're getting breaks of anywhere from a minimum of $4,762 in that four-year period to $57,438 for the top 1%. I can't quite get how arguing for a reduction in income tax at the high level when we talk about our revenue needs in this state still doesn't make sense. I understand that we overtax working poor. Oregon's like fifth worst in the nation for that, I think, because of our our brackets. But I really question the validity of giving what in essence is an additional tax break to the wealthy under your plan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, appreciate the concern and the interest. I guess the way I would respond to that, at least initially, and hopefully the committee and work groups will discuss this over the next week or two, but the way I would initially respond is that in this particular package, the percentage reduction in income taxes is smaller. It's about 10% to the quintile you're talking about. Now, at the bottom, it becomes a 20% income tax reduction. So I'm trying to make sure that it is indeed the working poor that get the biggest advantage out of the income tax break. The other thing I point out would be that with the earned income tax credit, I think that's an important factor. It's not been a big factor because we've had a 5%, you know, at this point in time, so that needs to be changed, and I'm certainly open to the committee's work on that to use that either in a non-refundable or refundable way to get at the point you're talking about. And the last point I guess I'd make is, you know, there's no free lunch here. I mean, the people that are in that quintile will probably be paying more taxes through their business, quite frankly. This is not a free ride. And I tell people very clearly that My own business, I'm going to end up paying a little bit more in taxes, at least up front, and I hope I can recoup that as I pass that on through. So they will be paying a little bit more, I think, up front than they are currently right now. So it really isn't as it would appear in terms of giving them a huge break. It's geared towards balancing things out.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Ringo.
Well, I also want to thank you for bringing this forward and getting the discussion going. I really think it's important. In my view, the biggest advantage this has over sales tax is the deductibility off the federal tax return. I mean, that is the big disadvantage of the sales tax. And I'm just wondering whether, do you agree with that, and are there other advantages that this has over the sales tax that you would emphasize?
Sure. I agree with Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo. I do agree. I think that is a huge plus for this particular feature over a sales tax. I won't badmouth a thoughtful sales tax proposal. They're looking at a streamlined sales tax and trying to get around some of the current problems that we have with that. But I think this does have advantages. This is geared towards economic development. Sounds contrary to the title of the bill. But I guess I would point out that with some of the incentives to invest, the capital gains reduction, quite frankly, the corporate income tax elimination, changing those rates a little bit, the way it does in here, and then that expensing, that's the big difference. You can expense off 100% of your capital investment that first year. Sales tax proposals I've seen don't actually do that, so I think this is another big plus on this proposal over the others. And I think as we go through the OTIM analysis, that'll be worn out.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Schrader, I've got a couple of concerns I'd like to share, and I think we need to reason together about how these things could possibly go together, or at least focus on those issues for which there may be no answers. There's thousands, literally, of small businesses in Oregon that are marginal today, just barely hanging on. Obviously, you know about that. It's true in your community as it is all over the state of Oregon. But the relative profitability of a company isn't at issue under the BAT tax. So if a company's marginal, it'll still pay as long as it has the two thresholds that trigger, $100,000 in gross income, $25,000 in capital expenditure. So marginal businesses that currently are able to avoid taxation and keep their doors open, if they hit these two thresholds, will pay the taxes. True or false?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, that is true.
Okay. And then startups that would be coming to Oregon who would invest, you know, furniture and equipment. I think if you think back to your startup days, you could not possibly have equipped and furnished your offices for less than $25,000. You know, the outer office furniture, the administrative costs for equipment, copiers, phones, et cetera. I mean, you're going to spend $25,000 just in a heartbeat getting a new business off the ground. And it's a pretty small business that doesn't generate $100,000 or isn't at least planned to. So startups would pay this tax?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't think so. If you look at the sheet that I think Mr. Warner passed out to you three sheets back into that packet, looking at the Oregon business activity tax base, all business types, the vast majority of small businesses will not pay this. They would fall under that $100,000. So I don't think it hurts startups, quite frankly.
I would argue that to start up a business today, you'd certainly have the intention of doing, I hope, better than $100,000 in gross in a year. I contend that they will. The other question would be certainly unprofitable businesses that have over $25,000 invested and $100,000 in cash flow, even though they're not making a profit, they'll pay this tax as well. And I guess I just want to know, how does the amount of the tax correlate with the ability to pay? You know, one of the features that we have in our tax system is, for better or for worse, because of its reliance on income tax or personal income and corporate income, Oregon's tax system is progressive. The lowest earners pay the least in taxes, and the highest earners pay the most in taxes. This seems to, without regard to the profitability or the ability to pay, impose a tax on marginal businesses that are just hanging on, startups that might come to Oregon, or businesses that are just flat trying to weather the storm and are currently unprofitable. So, you know, is my analysis of that incorrect? Are those, you know, whether they're profitable or not, regardless of the ability to pay, they'll be subject to the tax if they have $25,000 invested in capital investment and $100,000 in gross.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, some of that is accurate. We have different opinion on how it would affect. I think one of the points I tried to bring out in my testimony is this tax won't go into effect until January 05. So I would hope, and I think most of the common theology right now is that our economy will be recovering by that point in time. So to the extent that it would hurt people that are in a tough situation right now, I don't think so. I think what will happen is it will enable them to actually start making profit and not be taxed on that. They'll actually, the increase in income will go at a much higher rate with income tax than it will for business activities tax. This is a consumption tax. So I think if you're looking at diagonals, your income tax is going to go up like this and your business consumption tax is going to go up at a much slower rate. I think that's a huge plus for businesses that are trying to start up and get moving at this point in time. It is, and it is, it's a, I think it's a mistake to say it's totally resistant to changes in the economy and profitability of companies. My own business, for instance, times got tough. I reduced my labor costs. I laid off people. I also sold some equipment, and I'm not purchasing new equipment. So to that extent, I can. This is, it's a consumption tax, as you know, is somewhere halfway in between the very regressive property tax and the highly volatile income tax. It goes up and down at will. So it's an attempt to try and get at that very tough, uneasy middle state that doesn't prevent businesses from being successful and indeed maybe encourages them to be successful by encouraging proper investment strategies and giving targeted tax breaks to take that regressivity that currently exists in our out of our tax code. Right now, I would argue that our income tax is not very progressive because we start paying it, you know, at a very low level. At $13,000 income, you're paying income tax. At 26, you're paying the top rate. Now, if we had those rates spread out a little more, then I think you could say our income tax system be more progressive. So I don't think this is that onerous. And again, when I'm looking at trying to run my business, which is the state of Oregon right now, and fund essential services, relying on just one source of revenue strikes me as not very wise. And we ought to be doing better than that.
Mr. Chairman, just two more observations, and then I'll yield to somebody else in the committee. Oregon's per capita income is around $37,000, $38,000 per person, at least. In the metro area, it is, and rural is quite a bit lower than that.
So. About $12.
Yeah, exactly.
A year?
It's about $17,500 annually in rural areas. And with payroll taxes and overheads and other taxes, you really have to earn about 1.5 times that amount just to cover wages and self-employment tax, et cetera, for one person. So I'm just going to say the smallest of the small businesses, even a two-person business, probably is going to end up paying the business activity tax, at least, you know, if they're paying themselves the average wage of the state of Oregon for a family, they're probably going to end up with $100,000 in gross. 218,162,000 taxpayers currently fall below that threshold, and I'm worried that an approach like this we'll do what we've seen happen whenever we've increased taxes on anything. You know, we raised taxes on cigarettes and revenues started to fall off because people adapted their strategies to avoid the taxes. So is the message we're sending people with an approach like this, stop growing at $99,999 and for God's sake don't invest more than $24,999 in any business in the state of Oregon or you hit this VAT tax? So, you know, is the message now, you know, come visit but don't grow? I mean, these businesses are reporting in 1998 for the 1996 probably tax year, the 98 tax year. I'll bet these numbers, if you refresh them, look a little bit different. And with increase in business activity in Oregon, which we all hope will happen, we're working to find the strategies. I'm afraid you're going to find a lot more people that hit that $100,000 threshold pretty quickly. And I'm just worried that the fact is that many of the current taxpayers that fall below that threshold will hit that threshold. And I'm really worried that the message that we're really sending people is if you want to grow a business, maybe you better look at Idaho or Montana or Nevada or California or Washington. Because if you grow a business in Oregon over $100,000, you're going to get hit right in the teeth of the tax. And it's not going to be based on your ability to pay.
and it's not going to be based on the profitability of your company, and it's not going to be based on the product that you produce. It's only going to be based on the triggers that you hit of investment and income, gross income, not net. So, I think there's much in the approach that deserves consideration, but I'm worried about, some of these questions that will really hit the smallest of the small business harder than they will the larger businesses, which have more ability to pay and be flexible.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I just respectfully disagree with the good senator. I think this proposal actually does quite the opposite. It actually encourages businesses to be successful because you're not taxed on your profits. They're trading 100% reduction in corporate income tax, or if you're a small business, closely held business like mine, a 50% reduction in capital gains and a 10 to 20% reduction in personal taxes. I'm only paying a 2.75 business activities tax that I am going to pass on to the consumer. That's what a consumer does. So I'm looking at this, heck, I'm getting all these tax breaks, and I'm going to pass it on to the consumer. I'm not going to pay a whole lot. I'm fronting the cost. So I would disagree. I think actually it would work out to be a huge economic incentive once we get past the thought that, business education tax means businesses are paying, huge outrageous taxes. This is a consumption tax, and I make no bones about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions for Senator Schrader? Thank you very much. Appreciate all the hard work.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify, and hope this is first of maybe several hearings and maybe some work groups could be put together. If the chair wouldn't mind, I'd like to work with him on maybe doing something like that, because I know there's a lot of concerns out there. Thank you.
Well, I have a couple of bills down in Ways and Means to help me out with. I'd be happy to help on your work group.
Yes, sir.
Senator Starr.
Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this chart, have you seen this?
Yes.
Are you concerned about who gets hit more or less by the tax as it relates to industry sector?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. Biggest concern I had was there is one. Of course, every industry is going to come in here and say they can't raise their prices, so they're going to have a tough time with this. But there is one that I think that is very accurate, and that's the agricultural industry. So that's why that particular sector is exempted, frankly, in this particular proposal. I'm open to discussion on that. The reason this particular tax, I think, has some merit is that it hits both labor-intensive and capital-intensive businesses the same. It's not a tax just on payroll. It's not a tax just on capital equipment. And it covers both the service sector, manufacturing sector, crosses the whole spectrum. That's another advantage over sales tax. At least most of the sales taxes are retail on goods only. So this allows for a very small rate, a very small tax spread over a greater population, which I think is fair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
No, get back down to Ways and Means. Right now.
We have a list. I don't think we have another list, so this is it. So we have about 45 minutes, so folks could maybe limit to 5 minutes max. Mr. Groner, Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, Mr. Roach.
What's your name again?
Afternoon, whoever wants to.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME. I won't take a lot of your time. You've all complimented Senator Schrader for his leadership. I would say just a few short issues. Whether it's this package or another package that AFSCME supports, we certainly support revenue. And we believe that this is a revenue package that deserves greater attention and study, and so therefore we appreciate your holding the hearing today. Just a comment from me is that to me this is like a teeter-totter or a balance. I look at Oregon, and I've done a paper on it that I'll get to some of you if you're interested, at what we've done since 1990 on the cost side, bringing the teeter-totter down. And the cost side, everything from the Oregon Health Plan, Measure 5, that, by the way, costs us now $1 billion in property revenue per year. Measure 47 and 50, another billion a year, $2 billion gone to two measures at the local level. Measure 11, tax expenditures, to the point now we're paying more in tax expenditures than we're paying to the taxing entities. and we continue then to raid reserves to solve our problems. I don't believe that's reasonable. I think this is reasonable. I may have some differences with folks. The transportation package is a big issue to us and to all of you. I know that. But I can tell you that the amount of people it puts to work is far short of the economic growth we need. We need growth in the rural areas, in the timber industry. My union has been willing nationally to take a loan, to take stands on those issues. And I believe that as long as we're going to be the most dependent, not the highest income tax state, we're the most dependent, we're second highest to New York, that if we're going to be the highest, most dependent state in America, we need to grow the economy any way we can rather than raid reserves. But at the same time, we could grow the economy and grow the economy and grow the economy. And I take a look at the tax expenditure history that I've watched here for most of my life, having sat on the Revenue Committee and being involved with over 30 years on revenue issues. And I don't see the direct correlation between many of the tax expenditures that we have given and, in fact, the growth of the economy. What does that mean to me and my union, then, is that we're out of balance. We're out of balance in terms of what the voters have passed through ballot measures, what the legislature has allocated over session after session in terms of tax expenditures, whether good or bad. And we certainly agree there are many, many tax expenditures good. But the reason we like Senator Schrader's proposal is definitive, it's deductible. And again, we cannot just grow ourselves out of a recession. I'd only comment that having watched Ways and Means and most of the budgets and revenue set simultaneously over the last decades, once Measure 5 passed, I realized that we were in fact cutting short our state budgets time after time after time, far before the recession. And that was directly related to the $4.3 billion that is now no longer available to the general fund. That is a result of ballot measures. By that I mean that are dedicated and earmarked, that the people themselves, the other legislature, the citizens of this state. So it's my point of view, one, thank you for stepping to the plate, and to Senator Schrader for stepping to the plate. But from my point of view, it seems to me, in my union's point of view, the public has to step to the plate. We're beyond the letters to the editor that call for efficiencies. I realize how we take the polls. We know that 25% of the public believes there are waste. My members tell me of waste, not in your agencies, but local government. Excuse me, I won't pick you up. But they do believe there is waste. My problem is when I ask them, would you mind showing me quite specifically where the waste is, it's quite an essential service to someone else. And so what's waste to one isn't necessarily waste to someone else. So I think that word efficiency and waste has been abused. And in fact, we have a broken revenue system. This broken revenue system occurred prior to the recession. This only exacerbates the problem. And therefore, we not only support the work that's been put into this by my senator from my legislative, where I live in Oregon City, but also the work you're giving the public an opportunity, and probably there'll be other measures we may well support as well. So we appreciate your work on this, and thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 44,000 members in Oregon's K-12 and community college systems. We, too, are here to commend not only Senator Schrader for the work he's done and for his courage and daring to propose tax reform, something that very few people in this building have been willing to do, but also this committee for being willing to hear it. And thanks to all of you for believing enough that this is a bill that deserves an airing, as we do. Our association believes that Oregon's at a crossroads, and now's the time to decide whether we want to be at Mississippi with fir trees or whether we want to continue with our long and proud tradition of innovation and excellence. And I think especially when we're talking about public education, which is the key to the economic recovery for our state, we really need to think about how we want to respond to this fiscal crisis and to our broken tax system, and in a thoughtful way. I think the idea of having a work group is a wonderful idea, because our support for this is not without its caveats. We do have several concerns with the bill, which I'll outline in a minute. But I believe with all my heart that if there were such a work group and a consensus product could be derived with some improvements, that we could get a package that could not only have legs in this building but also pass in the general public. And that's obviously, whether this were enacted or referred, this is written as an enactment, we all know that we have to look at whether or not the public will accept it. And so we are realists in that regard. Most of all, I want you to know that we applaud the vision that is behind this proposal, but I will identify a couple examples of some of the concerns we have that limit our ability to give it our wholehearted endorsement. We worry, for example, about rolling back Oregon's progressivity piece in our tax system, which is, of course, the personal income tax, at least with respect to reducing the high end. That is the only piece of our tax system that's progressive, and that gives us some concern. We also believe that it would be wonderful if the earned income tax credit could be refundable for the poor, which would also help with the regressivity aspects. Thirdly, we worry that the pieces are interactive, that the parts of the bill that would reduce some taxes and then institute this new need to be linked with some legislative language that say that were there a referendum to repeal a piece of this bill, that the others would not take effect. Because what could actually happen, and under Oregon's Constitution, you don't have to do a referendum on the entire bill. You can do it on just a piece. And so I could just see the cuts to the taxes remaining in effect and the business education tax being subject to referendum. And we would not like to see that happen, making the situation even worse. So we would offer that cautionary note were you to take a look at amendments. We'd like to see some linkage language among those various different pieces. And finally, the net revenue for the 03-05 biennium that would be yielded in this plan, I would point out to you, is $381 million, according to your staff, and the hole that Oregon is confronting is $3.3 billion. So this would need, of course, to have some companion pieces, and we would humbly offer the tax expenditure proposals that you've heard us talk about before. We believe there is at least $1 billion to be harvested there as a companion piece with this or some other tax reform proposal, so that we actually come close to filling the entire hole that Oregon is staring down right now. As I said, those are our caveats. We do feel that we have some encouragement in the fact that recently some organizations in the business community have come forward to say that they're ready to step to the plate and pay their fair share. And we feel that's very encouraging as a sign that there is momentum building for tax reform in this building. This bill is a good first step. We believe it deserves your careful consideration, not just one hearing. And while we recommend some improvements, we are happy to support it in a general concept, and we're happy for finally having the opportunity to say that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Roach. I co-own a business in Portland called Plum Clothing. I'm a 26-year member of National Federation for Independent Businesses and a member of Oregon Business Association. I'm here. I support what's been said by my colleagues to the right, and would also add, just very specifically from my point of view as a retail shop owner and one of thousands around the state, I support the thrust of this bill and Senator Schrader's approach. I commend him for his leadership in coming up and presenting it, and want to add a real important piece that he briefly mentioned in his testimony, that this bill includes the whole economy. And those of us in the retail sector who would become tax collectors under most of the sales tax proposals don't have to feel picked on, because basically all businesses are paying into this tax, And I think that's a very important point in terms of the saleability of the tax, that all businesses, not just retailers, are pitching in and doing tax collection basically for the benefit of all the folks in Oregon. I mean, in particular schools, K through 12. So that's really my piece, is this is visionary in that it is dealing with the entire economy here in Oregon, and in particular includes the services economy, which is the growing part of the economy. Actually, the goods sector is a shrinking part of the economy. It'll probably remain that, and as services increase, it seems doesn't seem very visionary to exclude services from business activities if you want to build your economy. So that's basically the point I want to make, is that this includes services. I think that's very important for any kind of tax reform if we're going to be successful in having it achieve what we want it to achieve. And I want to thank you, as they did, for giving this an opportunity to be heard, this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment. First of all, thank you for coming to testify. I know that there was a big debate on this issue last session over in the House Revenue Committee, and I didn't listen to that testimony, and I think probably most people up here did not listen to that testimony. And I would find it helpful to hear some of the particulars from the business community as why they think this might not work. And I know there are a number are sitting listening, and I would like to hear that, whether it's in this hearing or at some other hearing. But and I appreciate your perspective as a retail businessman supporting this, and I hope we do get around to hearing all sides of the bill so that we can really evaluate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura, do you know if we ever surveyed public opinion on a gross receipts or value-added tax with income tax reductions and just kind of gauge their perception?
Mr. Chair, I am aware that there have been some polling done on those kinds of questions, and I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I'll try to provide that to you if I'm able to locate it.
Okay, thank you.
I remember seeing some on gross receipts that, you know, depending on the way the poll's conducted, it can come in with fairly high support to begin with, and then when it starts being attacked as a sales tax, it gets beat up pretty badly.
I don't think they ever did. I don't know if they did any polling on the business activity tax last time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Nesbitt. Mr. Berning, are you here on this bill? Are you still here? Okay. Not on this bill.
Tim can answer some polling
questions. Mr. Eaton and David Williams. Mr. Williams. Miss Eaton. I'm sorry.
That would be Cappy Eaton.
I know. I should have known
that.
You
better be very nice to Cappy Eaton. She's from a very nice part of the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I want to add my voice to the chorus of appreciation for hearing this bill and to Senator Schrader for putting it on the table. And myself, I'm going to sing a little bit of an old song and then try to spend a little more time with some new observations. The old song is, we continue to question whether we really need a third new tax. You can get confused by analogy sometimes, but people talk about the three-legged stool, obviously paint a picture where we can't stand straight on two legs, but if it's a bicycle, it can go just as fast, maybe a little shaky, but certainly faster than a tricycle. So I'm not sure we want to trade a two-wheeled system for a three-wheeled system, or a two-legged system for a three-legged system. Therefore, we have put forward proposals which would basically put the income tax back in the income tax, which we can do through eliminating or reducing tax expenditures on the income tax side, and also achieve more business tax effort through a property tax on commercial and industrial property. And I think those proposals still warrant consideration. I think it's a much tougher uphill push to get the voters to agree to a third new tax. Now, having said that, here's how our thinking is evolving on this point to some extent. If we stick with the two taxes we have, obviously we need fairly high effective tax rates on those two taxes, and we end up with the kinds of proposals I described. We're adding patches to the fringes of which basically a patchwork quilt of a tax system that we have now. We're not able to kind of get into that system and make structural change. When you do consider a third new tax, you have the ability to talk about what else will be changed if it's of a magnitude that you can both raise revenue and make significant offsets in improvements in the existing tax structure. So that's the advantage that Senator Schrader's proposal has. It kind of takes us to the point where we can look at making a lot of different changes. And he proposes making changes in the income tax. Now, if we went there, I think we'd say, wait a second, don't necessarily focus on capital gains and don't necessarily focus on the top bracket of the income tax. Let's stand back and ask ourselves what's most regressive about our income tax at both the state and federal level, and what would better support jobs or retard the growth of jobs. And we think the first place we ought to go, if we're looking at a big package, we want to make adjustments on the income tax side, is to give a credit to workers for the Social Security taxes they pay on their wages, which is the single most regressive feature of our federal tax system, a state income tax credit on that portion of their wages, which the lowest paid workers pay. And why not extend the same kind of credit to employers for the Social Security taxes they pay on their payrolls for their workers? We think on both ends that helps workers and creates added incentives for employers to create and maintain jobs. And I think those kinds of offsets go farther towards addressing the impacts that Senator Ferriolo just raised about conflicts with ability to pay, because you're creating added incentives for employing people through jobs. And I'd like to see how that lines up in an OTIM analysis, both on the worker side and on the employer side. And frankly, we have a lot more concern about how our tax system incentivizes or discourages jobs than we do about the company owner who comes here. And yes, this is a very favorable state for startups, and you know, the company owner who comes here and then leaves for Vancouver, Washington, when he's sitting on an appreciated stake in his company. We have less concern about that than we do about the company which leaves here and takes workers and jobs, takes jobs with them and leaves workers out of work. So I think the first place the focus should be, if we're looking at a third leg in a comprehensive system of reform, is looking at ways in which our tax system can better provide subsidies to workers and incentives for job creation than the system we have now. And I'll hopefully, if this goes forward, if there's a work group, I'd love to kind of refine these ideas and work on it, because we're saying, you know, if there's going to be this big effort for comprehensive tax reform, despite all the warning flags we've raised about it, this is a way we would encourage you to go.
Thank you. Tim, do you think we're overly dependent on our income tax in Oregon?
Without a rainy day fund, Senator, I think we are. We have to put some stabilizers on that bicycle, and I think we need a rainy day fund. We need to better manage kind of a high-speed tax system like we have, you know, which goes fast in good times and slows way down in bad times. And we need at least a well-constructed rainy day fund to do that.
I guess the fall, do you support, I guess, a speed break if you're, I mean, the kickers are essentially the way to do it, but some
kicker
form
directed to a rainy day fund makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
To us.
Other? Ms. Roms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Williams with the Oregon School Employees Association, representing 20,000 classified and certified employees working in Oregon's K-12, ESD's Community College, Head Start, and Park and Recreation Districts. Here to express support on behalf of OSCA for the -B8 amendments to House Bill 2747. As an aside, we also like the original bill as it stands as well. We want to applaud Senator Schrader's efforts and his drafting of this piece of legislation and his sort of kicking off the ball here and getting the discussion started with tax reform. There are several minor aspects to his proposal that we would defer with, and those have all been mentioned before. And we're also concerned that his proposal may not, in the end, raise enough money to fund Oregon's K-12 system. Just, you probably need no reminding, but for the record, of course, Oregon schools need nearly $6 billion to restore the cuts that were made during the special sessions, and nearly $7 billion in order to meet the goals outlined by the quality education model in statute, and even more than both of those to meet the 100% goals outlined by the No Child Left Behind Act mandated by the federal government. But to be totally clear, OSCA supports tax reform, has at every turn, and believes that tax reform is the key to returning Oregon to prominence in the nation as far as having world-class education and public safety and human services for all Oregonians. We support the efforts of the senator and the committee in addressing this issue and want to continue down that road. The pressure that Oregon's education funding system places on the state budget, as you all are aware, and certainly Senator Schrader, as Ways and Means co-chair, is intimately aware, is enormous. And by freeing up that funding stream and finding another way to fund our schools, it releases those budgetary pressures and will help to provide more funding and less pressure on other state-funded services and less pressure on education funding as a whole. Lastly, I want to highlight last summer OSCA asked legislative candidates to sign a pledge to help solve the school funding crisis in Oregon. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you should be buoyed by the fact that 15 of your colleagues and 35 of your colleagues in the House signed on to this pledge. And understanding that this proposal and others like it would require a three-fifths majority, we believe that this is a base from which we can build broad support for revising Oregon's tax system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Eaton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I represent a group that is grassroots, political, nonpartisan, and I want to speak specifically to two positions which the League has held for a long time and on which we do recurring research and updates. But first of all, I would add the voice of the League to our appreciation for beginning the dialogue on the need for new revenue to support education, public safety, and social services, as Senator Schrader's bill does. The League supports particularly having a long-term, stable funding source for public education. 2747 does this with at least the beginnings of a fund into which there is an ongoing, stable source of revenue to support our schools. And until we get at that point, our education system is going to continue to decline, and we're all well aware of what's been happening. And there's always discussion about the fact that, well, we're not going to attract business to our state unless we have a good economic development program. We also need to have a very strong educational program beginning pre-kindergarten and through college. And we need to have at least the beginning of that stable system, and that's why we would support the Business Education Fund, which is established for this bill. Our second long-term position has to do with having a balanced state tax system, whether it's two wheels, three legs, whatever. We are in a position where we have never had this, and we continue to be going down the wrong road with the income tax. So looking at a fair, equitable, stable tax system is another piece of this bill which puts into place the business education tax. In the long run, what we want to encourage this committee to do is to continue this dialogue that you're opening today and to have productive discussions on where we go from here, whether it's this bill or whether it's a conglomeration of a number of bills that look to increasing revenue. We also support the Oregon Revenue Coalition's look at tax expenditures, because none of these things are going to raise as much money as we believe is necessary to get us back to providing services for Oregonians, which they have come to expect and which are in tremendous decline. So we hope that you will continue this discussion. We hope that you will look at all the possible solutions for our fiscal crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corker.
Mr. Nesbitt, you probably have as much access as anyone to public polling over the years on, we do have these various discussions within the building of overdependency on income tax, no consumption tax. The reason for the two tax revolts in Oregon is that we have that working poor and small businesses are overtaxed, and we have a high income, high property tax because we don't have a consumption tax. You've heard all those discussions, and you've made comments yourself about, you know, not necessarily depending on the logic of the three legs of the stool, but I think we're under a lot of pressure this time to enact rather than refer. And I wondered what your observations are about, I mean, and there's every idea floating around this building. I mean, there's this idea, there's a Max Williams has a, you know, a sales tax. We've had discussions about business and occupation like taxes before. What's your view of, you know, the what the public's saying out there in terms of the polling you've seen on this? What's, I mean, if we enacted a sales tax and there was a referendum, for instance, you know, would a sales tax withstand a referendum better than, you know, adding a 11% bracket in income tax, for instance, on the wealthy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think a sales tax all by itself, not part of a package, it's doomed. With a package, it's even then an extreme uphill fight. I think if you're talking about introducing a gross receipts tax, I think most members of the public scratch their heads. They don't know quite what that means. It gets characterized as a sales tax. That becomes a hard sell. If it gets characterized as a tax to restore business support for our schools, I think it's perhaps an easier, but still difficult sell. None of it's easy. If you look at the taxes we already have, I think the income tax is the least hated, but certainly not loved. And the property tax is more hated, and the sales tax is most hated. And so you got to pick your way between very difficult alternatives. And that's why I said I've warned you in the past about the old maxim about comprehensive tax reform. You know, there are winners and losers, and the losers are always more angry than the winners are grateful. And so it all kind of comes down to the campaign and the interests that line up. I'm encouraged by the fact that the business community is saying we need to restore funding for services and business needs to make more of an effort. And on our part, we're willing to, you know, rethink a lot of our old ways of viewing the tax system. We're looking for, I think we ought to be able to come up with a tax package that we can call Fair Taxes for Good Schools and Good Jobs. Now, that's the title. Let's just fill in the details. Because I think our tax system needs to provide that kind of funding, and I think it nice provides those kinds of incentives to promote employment with some of the ideas I've already proposed. And I think the individual taxpayers need to feel like the tax burden that's shifted to them has been recognized and ameliorated to some extent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schweinhart, Ms. Lowe, Ms. Kelly.
Just two more.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Representative Hobson, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank and for the Oregon Law Center. And I want to join the chorus that is really giving you our gratitude for beginning some real dialogue on taxes in Oregon as it relates to some of the essential services and our need to fund them, whether it be education or whether it be Children's Protective Services or whether it be our courts. The in the statement that Senator Schrader shared with you when he was going through his plan, he indicated a willingness to revisit the proposal within his bill on the earned income tax credit and to make it refundable. And that is where I want to give some real special emphasis, because we have too many working poor in Oregon who are paying taxes that may not be the income tax that brings it up to the place where it isn't refundable. But look at a great many taxes we have in terms of gasoline, cigarettes, beer, wine. There are many places where consumers pay taxes. And you heard from Tim Nesbitt of AFL-CIO of the probably the most regressive tax for low income, and that is the Social Security. So we really do believe that if you would issue the or you would revisit the issue of refundability, that that would add some progressive parts to whatever proposal. And so whether it's proceeding with the income tax, as you just heard discussed, or whether it's proceeding with some of the changes to the income tax and then the business education tax, we do ask that you do include refundability of the earned income tax credit. I'd also like to just reinforce the invitation that Senator Schrader extended to you to develop a work group. I really think in the history of Oregon legislation, when we have put together real work groups within the legislative process, we have contributed to what is deliberative democracy, and that is what makes it possible to have representative democracy, so that you can make a decision and it will not have to be referred. Thank you.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, Representative Hobson, my name is Marcia Kelly and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Our members are the American Association of University Women of Oregon, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, Delta Kappa Gamma, which is education sorority, the Salem YWCA, the Oregon Women's Older Women's League, and the Oregon National Organization for Women, plus independent members. And I like to let people know that for the American Association of University Women, all you need is a college degree. You don't even have to be a woman. That is probably our broadest membership base, with over 3,000 women in the state, from the Wallowa County branch to Lakeview to Beaverton, Tigard, Portland, all up and down I-5. We have members in NISA. We try to advocate for all of these organizations, and one of the things that we have included in the Women's Rights Coalition agenda this year in our legislative platform is reasonable realignment of revenues for the state of Oregon, i.e. tax reform. We also echo the earned income tax credit being refundable for especially the low-income women or the low-income parents. And we echo everyone's Oregon Revenue Coalition. Let's look at the tax credits. When I was doing sort of a little bit of a rewrite for some of our members on the Revenue Coalition paper to put it into everyday language, I took a look at the first revenue tax expenditure report that was required in 1997. That had about $15 billion worth of tax credits. And this current revenue tax expenditure book has $25 billion. That's 97 to 2003. So we really think that there needs to be some real definitive work on the tax expenditures, and we would prefer not just a straight across the board, but looking at where they are regressive if you do a straight across the board and where it would be progressive. And we think that we would then echo Tim Nesbitt's, let's put the income back in the income tax.
Thank you.
Joe, have you joined the AAUW?
No, I haven't yet.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, Associate Oregon Industries. I'm here today to oppose House Bill 2747, the business activity tax. While AOI over the years has been in support of other tax restructuring measures, we have always opposed the VAT tax. House Bill 2747 would have damaging impacts on Oregon's economy. Clearly, this measure would be a hidden sales tax for Oregon consumers, including on such things as food and medicine. One of the goals of House Bill 2747 is to stabilize Oregon's revenue stream. From the perspective of business that would have to pay a new tax, the stability of government revenue would come at the expense of a conversion from a profits-based tax to an ongoing operating expense base regardless of income. This, at a time when business is least able to pay more or make such a change. Oregon businesses involved in international trade, a number that is increasing by efforts of business, the governor, as well as government public policy, this measure would be counterproductive in that it would make Oregon less competitive in international markets. Many of the traditional businesses which help form the backbone of Oregon's economy, such as timber, agriculture, and silicone chip manufacturers, are price takers, not price setters. If their tax burden is increased, they cannot pass that increase along in the price of their product, and their competitiveness and profitability will decline, again, at a time when business can least afford it. AOI believes we need changes in tax structure to promote Oregon economic development. Oregon's economic situation, including this 2.5% unemployment, higher than average energy prices, high capital gains, high minimum wage, high minimum marginal income tax, and on, have taken away Oregon's competitive edge. It's taken away the tools that enhance the ability for Oregon Economic Development Department to make Oregon business friendly. But it's really more serious than making Oregon business friendly. Over the last several months, the need to make Oregon a competitor in world markets and even more competitive in regional and national markets have become more important as we have become less competitive. It's about companies wanting to locate in Oregon, not relocating elsewhere. It's about Oregon manufacturing industry expanding their businesses here, not in plants in the Midwest. And it's about jobs. Unemployment in the U.S. continues to climb. We must use every and whatever tools and legislative ideas we have to make Oregon more attractive for any economic upswing when it begins. Oregon revenue currently depends on the working and Oregon working. 8.2% unemployment forces us to take advantage of any and every opportunity to increase employment in the private sectors. If you want livable wages, then you must reform land use laws, business regulation and taxes and make Oregon a place where manufacturing can thrive. Make no mistake, companies, executives, and hope are leaving Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, to that end, we support examining tax restructure ideas. We do not support House Bill 2747, and we don't think it's the right idea. However, we believe a better plan, a workable plan, and a plan that business can support can be developed. And in that end, we appreciate the opportunity to be here and more willing to talk about any opportunities that come up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Corcoran. Senator Corcoran.
Chair, Mrs. Swinehart, I don't understand this. You got the lowest business tax burden in the western states. We're 45th lowest out of 50. You guys don't support anything except cuts to capital gains and death tax. You know, it's not good to tax you during the good times. It's not good to tax you during the bad times. What is your idea about tax reform?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I probably question whether, I mean, we do have a tax structure. If you look at just an individual tax, I mean, businesses pay the income taxes, they pay business taxes, they pay regulations for setting up a business, they pay the same property taxes as everybody else pays. What we'd like to see is some type of structure in restructuring taxes to remove those things that make us less competitive. And that's the high rates we have on several different types of taxes. And we think we need to be more competitive out there. You know, other states are ready to move, and we are not. 8.2% unemployment is about a whole percent higher than everybody else in the nation.
Well, we're kind of ahead of the race if we're 45th out of 50, and we're just racing to the bottom.
Well, I question, where we are at this point versus...
It's only 44th.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would just like to thank and acknowledge the representatives of the League of Women Voters and the Society for University Women. They are continuous advocates for good government, openness, and encouraging lively debate, and I've enjoyed attending the forums and fairs that have been run in my part of the world with local chapter members. It's always interesting and lively when the League and the Society team up to support those events. What I've been hearing today is that people want to see dedicated funding for K-12. You know, they think that that's an important feature. They want to reduce the over-reliance on income taxes, corporate and personal.
Good question.
They want to reduce disincentives for business investment, because there are certainly those out there. And they want to stabilize the tax system. I'm not hearing anybody say, gee, we really need to do all this stuff on a revenue-neutral basis. I think that that might be a tripper, you know, around the barn for no particular purpose. So I'm interested to see, you know, what is catalyzed by the dialogue. You know, I think it's worthwhile having the conversation, and I appreciate Senator Schrader's work on the issue, and, Mr. Chairman, your willingness to hear the bill. I do have another concern. I just want to stick this on the record. We do, under the current tax code, have a very powerful incentive for investment in business. And that is that a small business owner nearing the end of his fiscal year with a profit on the books has an interesting prospect at hand. They can go into the tax accountants with a profit on the books, which is a taxable event, and they would take their corporate tax wherever that puts them. Or they can practice what is lawful, which is called tax avoidance, and they can invest in business equipment or services and grow the capacity of the business. And there's a powerful incentive to do that. They'll avoid paying the profit taxes if they do that. And so those profits potentially would go back into a business equipment investment or services to grow the capacity of the business, or they could distribute the profits as bonuses or wages. And in either of those cases, there's a feedback from the investment in the local service sector for consulting services or for equipment and services that would grow the business capacity. It zeroes out their profit, but it also spends the dollars in the local economy, which in turn produces the feedback model. Those places where they spend the money will have to pay income taxes. Or the bonus or increased wages are directly taxed at the higher rate. So the current system, in fact, does provide a really powerful incentive for small businesses nearing the end of their fiscal year to avoid the business taxes by investing those dollars back into the local economy. And I don't think that that is in the model that's before us with business activity tax. So I'd be concerned that we don't lose the feedback and don't lose the incentive for people investing. You know, tax avoidance is legal, and especially when it has a beneficial feedback effect. It's a good thing. So I just want to put that on the record, because I think if we do end up with a work group, you know, I'm sure the work group will need to look at dedicated funding and reducing the reliance on income taxes and reducing business disincentives and stabilizing the tax system. But I also want them to be aware that under the current tax code, there is a powerful incentive for small businesses to avoid taxes by reinvesting whatever profit they might have. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to lose those incentives as we go forward into a program. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good comment.
Mr. Chair?
Does the panel care to respond?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Farrelly, I agree with you. I think the idea is that if you can keep a business growing, and that's what it's really all about, is getting businesses and being able to grow, then that employs more people and that pays more taxes. So avoidance may not be the exact word you want to use, but it's a reinvestment of profits back into the business, which helps our economy overall and helps keep people employed.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think the choice for a small business person, since I think most of us have run them or tried to anyway, you've got a choice. You can go into your accountant and say, look, I made $10,000 this year. What's it going to cost me? And it's going to cost you 9%. Or your tax accountant may say, well, you know, you've been thinking about that new piece of equipment. If you invest that, you zero out your profits. And you won't pay the taxes, but you'll have this expenditure that grows your capacity. Or you can bonus your employees, and they likely will pay more than 9%. So the feedback model is important. I just think it's important for us not to lose sight of the fact that we didn't just wake up in a brand new world and have a tax structure that we have. There are reasons why we do what we do in the tax structure. And some of them are to incent the feedback model. So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Not to have a real debate here, but I guess the flip side is that we want businesses to do what's efficient for that business, not just avoid taxes. And I would rather have our tax structure not be influencing those investment decisions so much. I'd rather have businesses do the investments that they need to do to grow their business without having undue incentives that allow them to avoid taxes. Just a question for you, Mr. Schweihart. I mean, you know, there's statistics we use frequently that says we have one of the lowest business tax burdens in the country, the lowest in the western states is from the Utah tax study. I mean, does AOI accept that as accurate?
I haven't seen the study.
It's a Utah tax study. We've referenced it frequently here in the Senate Revenue Committee, and I'm just wondering whether your organization accepts that as an accurate analysis.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I honestly have not seen that study, and what chances are we would not agree with. I mean, depending on whose statistics you look at and what they bring into the what they bring on the table as to what's taxable and what isn't. If you look at one or two or three taxes versus five, six, or seven taxes, it may change the picture.
Well, exactly. I think there are a number of assumptions that you can make, and so it isn't completely objective. But on the other hand, it's a University of Utah study, so it is independent. It's not. There's no political agenda with regard to Oregon's policy choices, but at least that independent analysis indicates we're the lowest of the 11 western states. And I would just be interested in why your organization might not think it's an accurate analysis.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I will get a copy of that analysis and let you know.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Ringo? Thank you, particularly the panel, and we'll call up the next couple of witnesses. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. And then we have Michael Slider. Mr. Slider, go ahead. We'll have Ms. Buchanan follow you up.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Ferrioli, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. I'm Michael Slider with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent 40,000 state and local government employees, private nonprofit employees, and home health care workers. I want to add my thanks to the committee and to Senator Schrader for beginning this discussion about revenue and tax reform to that of my colleagues. We're in this room for the reason that many people are or were today, to try and find a solution to the state budget problems that are devastating some people's lives today and denying other people opportunities for a better future. Today in Oregon, people with mental illnesses are dying because they lack needed prescription drugs or treatment. Children are being sent home early without a full school year's education, and courts are operating 4 days a week, and nonviolent offenders are being released without a trial. In the past year, we've come a long way from the vision of public services the legislature adopted and funded in the last biennium. We are, in fact, about $3.3 billion away from that vision. And it's no mystery why we're in that situation. Not only is our state over-reliant on the income tax, but we also give away too much of that revenue stream in tax loopholes when economic times were good. Now that times are bad, it's our expectation that the legislature take responsibility, step up to the plate, and enact real reform and close our $3.3 billion budget hole. One solution that's being advocated by the Revenue Coalition, which our union supports, is to eliminate or reduce tax expenditures. With this approach, we can recover approximately $1 billion, but this still leaves us over $2 billion short. And while we're halfway into the session, we have not seen many credible solutions.
Excuse me. I just won't sit here and listen to somebody say that we're in June and we're only halfway through the session.
Thank you.
That's my bad.
I beg your pardon. That's not a good deal.
Fortunately, Senator Schrader has stepped forward with a comprehensive proposal for tax reform with his Dash V8 amendment to House Bill 2747. This tax measure creates a business activity tax and gives the state a much-needed third leg of the revenue stool, training wheels on the bike, or whatever other metaphor we want to use. The beauty of this proposal is that it recognizes political reality by splitting the difference between a straight consumption tax and a straight business tax. SEIU Local 503 supports the concept of a business activity tax and many of the measures that are in Dash B8 amendments as one set of responsible solutions to the revenue crisis facing Oregon. And I'd like to add my comments to that of Mr. Nesbitt, who pointed out that this tax is worthwhile in consideration of the other offsetting tax proposals in it, and it's not something that is as useful or as easily supported if it's a standalone proposition. And we stand ready to work with the author, this committee, and any potential work group to address the substantive issues raised by this amendment, most importantly, its potential regressivity. Well, thank you.
Mr. Slater, I apologize for butchering your name, and I'll ask the panel if they have any questions for Mr. Slater. Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Slater.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ms. Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Suppose you want to inject some facts into this discussion.
Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Senator Schrader just asked the department to speak briefly on the administrative aspects of the proposal and whether or not we could administer it, and of course the answer is yes, we could. Once it's fully phased in, we would expect that the costs would be not significantly different than the excise tax that we currently administer. The transition period, of course, there would be additional costs incurred. Particularly 2005 tax year might be something that someone might consider adjusting. That particular year, according to the bill, the corporations would be subject to both the excise tax and the new business education tax. I'm not sure whether that was intentional or simply an oversight in drafting, but there would be that requirement for that 1 year. Following that, we would phase in the business education tax, but there would, of course, still be excise tax returns that would need to be processed, adjusted in audit, and so forth. And then also, to the extent that we could keep definitions that there are in current law that would simplify the administration and also the compliance for corporate taxpayers, such as the allocation and apportionment rules and so forth, and we'd be happy to work with anyone that wanted to try to develop this product. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Ms. Buchanan, have you fed back that information to the proponents and particularly Senator Schrader about the anomalous year and some of the transition costs that you might incur?
Senator Ferrioli, I did speak with the senator before this hearing.
So. Okay. I think that's extremely valuable if you just keep in touch with him on logistics.
Thank you.
Questions from the panel? So it sounds like that was a yes.
Thank you, sir.
You can hear it. Oh, Ms. Buchanan.
Yes, sir.
You're not close to early retirement or pushing the birth envelope, are you? Because we're going to need somebody who remembers having this conversation in the future.
I'm sure retirement is a very long way away from me, Mr. Vice Chair.
That may be a blessing for the members of the panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any other person here present that wishes to give testimony? It looks like we've run through the list on the sign-up sheets. If not, I'll thank Representative Hobson, who is here as a guest for the panel. She was called away, and with that, we will call the public hearing on House Bill 2747 to a close, and we will, with that, adjourn the Senate Revenue Committee.